were not bridge burners. The stripping away of that label was an earned thing, a recognition brought by deeds. Surrey was a recruit because the thought of having her inextricably enfolded within the bridge burners burned like a hot knife in the throat of everyone in his squad. And that was something to which the sergeant himself was not immune. As all of this flashed through Whiskey Jack's thoughts, his usually impassive expression failed him. In his head he replied, "Young? No. You can forgive the young. You can answer their simple needs, and you can look in their eyes and find enough there that is recognizable. But her? No. Best to avoid those eyes in which there was nothing that was young. Nothing at all."
"Let's get you moving," Ducek growled. "Mount everyone up."
The High Fist turned to say a few last words to the sergeant, but what he saw in Whiskey Jack's face killed those words in his throat. Two muted thunderclaps sounded in the city as the east spread its crimson cloak skyward. The first report followed scant minutes later by the second. The last of the night's tears churned down gunnels and swirled along street gutters. Muddy puddles filled potholes, reflecting the thinning clouds overhead with an opaque cast. Among the narrow, crooked alleys of Pale's Crail Quarter, the chill and damp of the night clung to the dark spaces with tenacity. Here the mould-laden bricks and worn cobbles had swallowed the second thunderclap, leaving no echo to challenge the patter of water droplets. Down one aisle, winding south along the outer wall, loped a dog the size of a mule. Its massive head was slung low, forward in front of the broad, bunched muscles of its shoulders. That it had seen a night without rain was marked by its dusty, dry, mottled grey and black fur. The animal's muzzle was speckled with grey, and its eyes glowed amber. The hound, marked seventh among Shadow Throne's servants and called Gear, hunted. The quarry was elusive, cunning, and swift in its flight. Yet Gear felt close. He knew that it was no human he tracked. No mortal man or woman could have escaped his jaws for so long. Even more astonishing, Gear had yet to catch a glimpse of the quarry. But it had trespassed. With impunity, it had entered the Shadow Realm, trailing Shadow Throne himself, and strumming all the webs Gear's lord had spun. The only answer to such an affront was death. Soon the hound knew he would be the hunted one, and if those hunters came in numbers and in strength, Gear would be hard-pressed to continue his search. There were those within the city who had felt the savage partings of the fabric. And less than a minute after passing through the Warren's Gate, Gear's hackles had stiffened, telling him of nearby magic's burgeoning. Thus far the hound had eluded detection, but that would not last. He moved silent and cautiously through the maze of shanties and lean-tos, crouching against the city wall, ignoring the occasional denizen come out to taste the dawn's rain-cleansed air. He stepped over the beggars sprawled in his path. Local dogs and ratters gave him one glance, then slunk away, ears flattened and tails sweeping the muddy ground. As Gear rounded the corner of a sunken stone house, the morning breeze brought his head round. He paused, eyes searching down the street opposite him. Mist drifted here and there, and the first carts of the lesser merchants were being pulled out by figures wrapped warm against the chill. The hound was running out of time. Gear's eyes travelled down the length of the street, focusing on a large walled estate at the far end. Four soldiers lounged before its gate, watching passers-by with little interest and talking among themselves. Gear's head lifted, his study finding a shuttered window on the estate's second floor. Anticipation and pleasure surged through the hound. He had found the trail's end. Lowering his head again, he moved, his gaze unwavering on the four guards. The shift had ended. As the new Marines approached, they both noticed that the gate was unlocked, ajar.
"What's this?" one asked,
eyeing the two drawn faces of the soldiers who stood against the wall.
"It's been that kind of night," the elder responded, "the kind where you don't ask questions."
The two new men exchanged glances. Then the one who had spoken gave the older man a nod and a grin.
"I know the kind. Well, get on then. Your cuts are waiting."
The older man shifted his pike and seemed to sag. His gaze flicked to his partner, but the young man had his attention on something up the street.
"I guess it's too late now," the older man said to the newcomers, "meaning it won't happen, and so it don't matter. But if a woman shows up, a bridge burner, you let her through, and keep your eyes on the walls."
"Look at that dog,"
the younger soldier said.
"We hear you," said the new man. "Life in the second."
"Look at that dog," the young Marine repeated.
The others turned to look up the street. The old guard stared, his eyes widening. Then he hissed a curse and fumbled with his pike. None of the others managed even that much before the hound was upon them. Sleepless, Tattersail lay flat on her back on the bed in the outer room. Her exhaustion had reached a point where even sleep eluded her, so she stared at the ceiling, her thoughts wandering in a disordered review of the past 7 days. Despite her initial anger at being embroiled in the bridge burner schemes, she had to acknowledge the excitement she felt. The desire to collect her possessions and open a warren, away from the Empire, away from Hairlock's madness and hunger, away from the field of an endless war, now seemed an ancient one, born of a desperation she no longer felt. But it was more than just a renewed sense of humanity that compelled her to stay to see it through. The bridge burners, after all, had shown again and again that they could take care of their own affairs. No, she wanted to see Tayshran pulled down. It was a truth that frightened her. Hunger for vengeance poisoned the soul. And it was likely that she would have to wait a long time to see Tayshran's just demise. She wondered if, having fed on that poison for so long, she might not end up viewing the world with Hairlock's shining, bright, mad eyes.
"Too much," she muttered. "Too much all at once."
A sound at the door startled her. She sat up.
"Oh," she said, scowling. "You've returned."
"Safe and sound," Hairlock said. "Sorry to disappoint you, Sail."
The marionette waved one tiny gloved hand, and the door behind him closed, its latch falling into place.
"Much feared, these hounds of shadow," he said, sauntering into the room's center and pirouetting once before sitting down, legs splayed and arms hanging limp. He sniggered. "But in the end, nothing more than glorified mutts. Stupid and slow and sniffing at every tree. Finding naught of sly Hairlock."
Tattersail leaned back and closed her eyes.
"Quick Ben was displeased by your sloppiness."
"Fool," Hairlock spat. "I leave him to his watching. I leave him convinced that such knowledge has power over me, while I go where I choose. He eagerly lays claim to commanding me, a foolishness I give him now to make my vengeance sweeter."
She had heard it all before and knew he was working on her, seeking to weaken her resolve. Unfortunately, he was succeeding in part, for she felt doubt. Maybe Hairlock was telling the truth. Maybe Quick Ben had already lost him, yet remained ignorant of the fact.
"Keep your vengeance for the man who stole your legs, and then your body," Tattersail said dryly. "Tayshran still mocks you."
"He'll pay first,"
Hairlock shrieked. Then he hunched down, gripping his sides.
"One thing at a time," he whispered.
From the compound beyond the window came the first screams. Tattersail bolted upright as Hairlock shouted,
"Found! I mustn't be seen, woman!"
The marionette leaped to his feet and scurried to his box against the far wall.
"Destroy the hound! You've no choice!"
Scrambling, he opened the box and climbed inside. The lid thudded into place, and the nimbus of a protective spell suffused it. Tattersail stood by the bed, hesitating. Wood shattered below, and the building shook. Men shrieked. Weapons clanged. The sorceress pushed herself upright, terror seeping into her limbs like molten lead.
"Destroy a hound of shadow?"
Heavy thumps rattled the window, as if bodies being flung aside on the floor below. Then the thumps reached the foot of the stairs, and the screaming stopped. From the compound she heard soldiers shouting. Tattersail drew on her thyre warren. Power swept into her and pushed aside the paralyzing fear. She straightened, all exhaustion gone, and swung her gaze on the door. Wood creaked. Then the timber panel exploded inward, as if flung from a catapult, and was instantly buffeted aside by Tattersail's magical shield. The twin impacts shattered it, flinging shards and splinters against the ceiling and walls. Glass broke behind her, the window's shutters springing open. An icy wind roiled into the room. The hound appeared, its eyes yellow flames, the muscles of its high shoulders taut, rippling under its skin. The creature's power swept like a wave over Tattersail, and she drew a sharp breath. The hound was old, older than anything she had ever encountered. It paused in the doorway, sniffing the air, blood dripping from its black lips. Then its gaze fixed on the iron-bound box against the wall to Tattersail's left. The beast stepped forward.
"No,"
she said. The hound froze. Its massive head swung slow and measured to her, as if it was noticing her for the first time. Its lips peeled back to reveal the luminescent gleam of canines the length of a man's thumb.
"Damn you, Hairlock! I need your help! Please!"
A white strip flashed above the hound's eyes as the lids snapped back. It charged. The attack was so swift that Tattersail was unable to raise her hands before the beast was upon her, surging through her outer magic as if it was no more than a brisk wind. Her closest defenses, a layering of high wards, met the hound's charge like a stone wall. She felt cracks streak outward, deep fissures reaching through to her arms and chest with a snapping sound immediately replaced by spurting blood. This, and the hound's momentum, flung her back through the air. The wards at her back cushioned the blow as she hit the wall beside the window. Mortar puffed into the air around her, and fragments of crushed brick scattered across the floor. The hound had fallen to its knees. Shaking its head, it regained its feet, snorted, then attacked again. Tattersail, her wits rocked by the first charge, weakly lifted one blood-streaked arm before her face, unable to do anything else. As the hound sprang into the air, jaws open and reaching for her head, a wave of grey light struck the beast in the side, throwing it into the bed to Tattersail's right. Wood crunched. With a grunt, the hound was up again, wheeling this time to face Hairlock, who stood perched atop his box, glistening with sweat and arms raised.
"Oh, yes, Gear," he shrilled. "I'm your quarry."
Tattersail slumped, then leaned to one side and vomited on the floor. A chaotic warren swirled in the room, a miasma that churned into her like riotous pestilence. It radiated from Hairlock, invisible pulses of grainy grey shot through with black. The hound eyed Hairlock, its sides heaving. It was as if it was trying to dispel the waves of power from its brain. A low growl rumbled in its chest, its first sound. The wide head sagged. Tattersail stared, then understanding struck a hammer blow to her chest.
"Hound!" she screamed. "He's reaching for your soul! Escape! Get out of here!"
The beast's growl deepened, but it did not move. None of the three noticed the door to the inner bedroom opening off to the left, or the halting appearance of Captain Parron, wrapped in the colourless woolen blanket that covered him down to his ankles. Pale and drawn, the man moved forward, a blank cast to his eyes, which were fixed on the hound. As the invisible battle of wills continued between Gear and Hairlock, Parron stepped closer. The movement caught Tattersail's eye. She opened her mouth to shout a warning, but Parron moved first. The blanket parted to reveal a longsword, point flashing outward as he extended into a full lunge. The sword sank into Gear's chest, even as the man leaped back, withdrawing the lunge, twisting the weapon as he pulled it clear. A bellow thundered from Gear's throat. The hound staggered back into the ruins of the bed, biting at the wound, gushing blood from its side. Hairlock screamed in rage and jumped forward, closing in on Gear. Tattersail scythed one foot into the puppet's path, flinging him against the far wall. Gear howled. A dark rift opened around him with the sound of tearing burlap. He whirled and plunged into the deepening shadow. The rent closed and was gone, leaving in its wake a rippling of cold air. Astonished beyond her pain, Tattersail swung her attention to Captain Parron and the bloodied sword in his hands.
"How?" she gasped. "How could you have pierced the hound's magic? Your sword?"
The captain looked down at it. "Just lucky, I suppose."
"Open!"
Hairlock hissed as he regained his feet and glared at Tattersail.
"Hood's curse on the fools! And you, woman, this I'll not forget. You will pay, I swear it."
Tattersail looked away and sighed. A smile touched her lips as words uttered earlier now returned with new, grim meaning.
"You'll be too busy staying alive, Hairlock, to start on me. You've given Shadowthrone something to think about, and you'll live to regret his attention, puppet. Deny that, if you dare."
"I'm returning to my box," Hairlock said, scrambling. "Expect Taserin here in minutes. He'll say nothing, sorceress."
He clambered inside.
"Nothing."
The lid slammed shut. Tattersail's smile broadened, the taste of blood in her mouth like an omen, a silent, visible warning to Hairlock of things to come. A warning she knew he couldn't see. That made the taste almost sweet. She tried to move, but it seemed that a chill had come to her limbs. Within her mind, visions floated, but walls of darkness closed in around them before they could register. She felt herself fading. A man's voice spoke close by, urgent.
"What do you hear?"
She frowned, trying to concentrate. Then she smiled.
"A spinning coin. I hear a spinning coin."
Book 2. Darujistan. What windfall has brushed our senses? This rocking thunderhead that scraped the lake's placid waters and spun a single day's shadows like a wheel, that rolled us from dawn to dusk while we tottered our tender ways. What windlass crackles dire warnings? There in the gentle swells that tossed a bobbing cork our way, with its fine magenta scent wafting like a panoply of petals that might be ashes in twilight's crimson smear. Rumour born. Fisher. Birthdate unknown. Chapter 5. And if this man sees you in his dreams, while you rock in the season's brooding night, 'neath a tree's stout branch, and your shadow is hooded above the knotted rope, so will the winds of his passing twitch your stiffened limbs into some semblance of running. Rumour born. Fisher. Birthdate unknown. 907th year in the third millennium, The season of Phandarei and the year of the Five Tusks. 2,000 years since the birth of Darujistan, the city. In his dream, the small round man found himself leaving the city of Darujistan through Two Ox Gate as he headed toward the setting sun. The tattered tails of his faded red waistcoat flapped in his haste. He had no idea how far he would have to walk. Already his feet ached. There were miseries in the world, and then there was misery. In times of conscience, he held the world's concerns above his own. Fortunately, he reflected, such times were few. And this, he told himself, was not one of them.
Alas, the very same dream propels these many-toed implements beneath these wobbly knees. He sighed. Ever the same dream.
And so it was. He saw before him the sun riding the distant hilltop, a copper disc through wood smoke haze. His feet carried him down the winding dirt street of Gadrubi shantytown, the shacks and huts on either side crouching in the gathering gloom. Old men wrapped in the dingy yellow rags of lepers squatted over nearby cook fires, falling silent as he passed. Similarly clad women stood by the muddy well, pausing in their endless dunking of cats. A bemusing activity, its symbolism lost on the man as he hurried past. He crossed Mighton River Bridge, passing through the dwindling Gadrobi herder camps, out onto the open road flanked by vineyard plantations. He lingered here, thinking of the wine these succulent grapes would produce. But dreams carried on with their own momentum, and the thought was but fleeting in its passage. He knew his mind was in flight, fleeing the doomed city at his back, fleeing the dark, brooding smudge in the sky above it, but most of all, fleeing all that he knew and all that he was. For some, the talent they possessed found its channel through a toss of knuckle bones, the reading of heat fractures and scapulae, or the facet of the deck of dragons. For Cropper, he had no need of any such affectations. The power of divination was in his head, and he could not deny it, no matter how hard he tried. Within the walls of his skull rang the dirge of prophecy, and it echoed through his bones. He muttered under his breath,
"Of course, this is a dream, the flight of sleep. Perhaps, thinks Cropper, he will in truth escape this time. None could call Cropper a fool, after all. Fat, with sloth and neglect, yes, inclined to excesses, indeed. Somewhat clumsy with a bowl of soup, most certainly. But not a fool. Such times are upon us when the wise man must choose. Is it not wisdom to conclude that other lives are of less importance than one's own? Of course, very wise. Yes, Cropper is wise."
He paused to catch his breath. The hills and the sun before him seemed no closer. Such were dreams like the hastening of youth into adulthood, a precipitous course one could never turn back on. But who mentioned youth? Or one youth in particular?
"Surely not wise Cropper. His mind wanders. Cropper excuses the pun magnanimously. Racked by the misery of his souls, which are tired, nay, half worn out from this reckless pace. Blisters have already appeared, no doubt. The foot cries out for a warm, soapy balm. Its companion joins in the chorus. Ah, such a litany, such a wail of despair. Cease complaining, dear wings of flight. How far is the sun, anyway? Just beyond the hills, Cropper is certain. No more than that, surely. Yes, as certain as an ever-spinning coin. But who spoke of coins? Cropper proclaims his innocence."
A breeze swept into his dream, down from the north, carrying with it the smell of rain. Cropper began fastening his threadbare coat. He drew in his belly in an effort to secure the last two buttons, but succeeded in clasping only one.
"Even in sleep," he groaned,
Guilt makes its point.
He blinked against the wind.
Rain? But the year has just begun. Does it rain in the spring? Crapper has never before concerned himself with such mundane matters. Perhaps this scent is no more than the lake's own breath. Yes, indeed. The question is settled.
He squinted at the dark ridge of clouds above Lake Azure.
Must Crapper run? Nay, where is his pride, his dignity? Not once have they shown their faces in Crapper's dreams. Is there no shelter on yon road? Ah, Crapper's feet are flailed. His soul's blood in sheds of throbbing flesh. What's this?
Up ahead was a crossroads. A building squatted on a low rise just beyond. Candlelight bled from its shuttered windows. Crapper smiled.
Of course, an inn. Far has the journey been. Clear the need for a place of rest and relaxation for the weary traveller. Such as Crapper, wizened adventurer, with more than a few leagues under his belt, not to mention spanning it.
He hurried forward. A broad, bare-limbed tree marked the crossroads. From one heavy branch, something long and wrapped in burlap swung creaking in the wind. Crapper spared it but the briefest glance. He came to the path and began his ascent.
"Ill judgment," pronounces Crapper. "Inns for the dusty journeyman should not sit atop hills. The curse of climbing is discovering how great the distance yet to climb. A word to the proprietor shall be necessary. Once sweet ale has soothed the throat, slabs of juicy red meat and broiled yams eased the gullet, and clean, anointed bandages clothed the feet. Such repairs must take precedence over flaws in planning, such as Crapper sees here."
His monologue fell away, replaced by gasps as he struggled up the path. When he arrived at the door, Crapper was so winded that he did not even so much as look up, merely pushed against the weathered panel until it swung inward with a squeal of rusty hinges.
"Alas!"
he cried, pausing to brush the sleeves of his coat.
"A foamy tankard for this!"
His voice died as he surveyed the array of grimy faces turned to him.
"Methinks the business is poor,"
he mumbled. The place was indeed an inn, or it had been, perhaps a century past.
"'Tis rain in the night air,"
he said to the half-dozen beggars crouched around a thick tallow candle set on the earthen floor. One of the fellows nodded.
"We will grant you audience, hapless one."
He waved at a straw mat.
"Be seated and entertain our presence."
Crapper raised an eyebrow.
"Crapper is graced by your invitation, sire."
He dipped his head, then strode forward.
"But please, do not think he is bereft of contributions to this honored gathering."
He sat down cross-legged, grunting with the effort, and faced the one who had spoken.
"He would break bread with you all."
From a sleeve he withdrew a small rye loaf. A bread knife appeared in his other hand.
"Known to friends and strangers alike is Crapper, the man now seated before you. Inhabitant of yon glittering Darujistan, the mystic jewel of Jenabacus, the juicy grape ripe for picking."
He produced a chunk of goat cheese and smiled broadly at the faces before him.
"And this is his dream."
"So it is,"
the beggar's spokesman said, his lined face crinkling with amusement.
"It ever pleases us when we taste your particular flavour, Crapper of Darujistan, and always we are pleased at your travelling appetites."
Crapper laid down the rye loaf and cut slices.
"Crapper has always considered you mere aspects of himself, a half-dozen hungers among many, as it were. Yet, for all your needs, you would urge what of your master? That he turn back from his flight, of course. that one's own skull is too worthy a chamber for deception to reign. And yet Crupper assures you from long experience that all deceit is born in the mind, and there it is nurtured while virtues starve.
The spokesman accepted a slice of bread and smiled.
Perhaps we are your virtues, then.
Crupper paused to study the cheese in his hand.
A thought Crupper has not considered before now, mingling with the silent observation of mould on this cheese. But, alas, the subject is in danger of being lost within the maze of such semantics. Nor can beggars be choosers when it comes to cheese. You have returned once again, and Crupper knows why, as he has already explained with admirable equanimity.
The coin spins, Crupper. Still spins.
The spokesman's face lost its humour. Crupper sighed. He handed the chunk of goat cheese to the man seated on his right.
Crupper hears it, he conceded wearily. He cannot help but hear it. An endless ringing that sings in the head. And for all that Crupper has seen, for all that he suspects to be, he is just Crupper, a man who would challenge the gods in their own game.
Perhaps we are your doubts, the spokesman said, which you have never been afraid to face before, as you do now. Yet even we seek to turn you back. Even we demand that you strive for the life of Darujistan, for the life of your many friends, and for the life of the youth at whose feet the coin shall fall.
It falls this very night,
Crupper said. The six beggars nodded at this, though mostly they remained intent on the bread and cheese.
Shall Crupper accept this challenge, then? What are gods, after all, if not the perfect victims?
He smiled, raising his hands and fluttering his fingers.
For Crupper, whose sleight of hand is matched only by his sleight of mind? Perfect victims of confidence, claimed Crupper, even blinded by arrogance, ever convinced of infallibility. Is it not a wonder that they have survived this long?
The spokesman nodded and said, around a mouthful of cheese,
Perhaps we are your gifts, then. Wasting away, as it were.
Possibly, Crupper said, his eyes narrowing. Yet only one of you speaks.
The beggar paused to swallow. Then he laughed, his eyes dancing in the candlelight.
Perhaps the others have yet to find their voice, Crupper. They await only their master's command.
My, Crupper sighed, as he prepared to stand. But Crupper is full of surprises.
The spokesman looked up.
You return to Darujistan?
Of course,
Crupper replied, gaining his feet with a heartfelt groan.
He merely stepped out for a breath of night air. So much cleaner beyond the city's crumbling walls, don't you agree? Crupper must needs exercise to hone his already prodigious skills. A walk in his sleep. This night, he said, hitching his thumbs in his belt, the coin falls. Crupper must take his place in the center of things. He returns to his bed, the night still young.
His eyes travelled among the beggars. All seemed to have gained weight, a healthy, robust colour to their upturned faces. Crupper sighed with satisfaction.
It has, pronounces Crupper, been a pleasure, gentlemen. Next time, however, let us settle on an inn that is not on a hilltop. Agreed?
The spokesman smiled.
Ah, but Crupper, gifts are not easily attained, nor are virtues, nor are doubts easily overcome, and hungers are ever the impetus to climbing.
Crupper's eyes narrowed on the man.
Crupper is too clever, by far, he muttered.
He left their company and shut the creaking door softly behind him. Returning down the path, he came to the crossroads and stopped in front of the burlap-wrapped figure swinging from the branch. Crapper planted his fists on his hips and studied it.
"I know who you are," he said jovially. "The final aspect of Crapper to complete this dream's array of those faces facing him, which are Crapper's own. Or so you would proclaim. You are humility, but, as everyone knows, humility has no place in Crapper's life. Remember that. So, here you will stay."
With that he moved his gaze to the great city lighting the eastern sky blue and green.
"Ah, this wondrous fiery gem that is Darujastam is home to Crapper. And that," he added as he began to walk, "is as it should be."
From the wharf sprawled along the shore of the lake, upward along the stepped tiers of the Gadrobi and Daru districts, among the temple complexes and the higher estates, to the summit of Majesty Hill where gathers the city's council, the rooftops of Darujastan presented flat tops, arched gables, coned towers, belfries and platforms crowded in such chaotic profusion as to leave all but the major streets forever hidden from the sun. The torches marking the more frequented alleyways were hollow shafts that gripped pumice stones with fingers of blackened iron. Fed through ancient pitted copper pipes, gas hissed balls of flame around the porous stones, an uneven fire that cast a blue and green light. The gas was drawn from great caverns beneath the city and channeled by massive valves. Attending these works were the grey faces, silent men and women who moved like spectres beneath the city's cobbled streets. For 900 years, the breath of gas had fed at least one of the city's districts. Though pipes had been sundered by raging tenement fires and gouts of flame reached hundreds of feet into the sky, the grey faces had held on, twisting the shackles and driving their invisible dragon to its knees. Beneath the rooftops was an underworld forever bathed in a blue glow. Such light marked the major avenues and the oft-frequented, narrow and crooked thoroughways of the markets. In the city, however, over 20,000 alleys, barely wide enough for a two-wheeled cart, remained in shadow, broken only by the occasional torch-bearing citizen or the globed lanterns of the city watch. By day, the rooftops were bright and hot beneath the sun, crowded with the fluttering flags of domestic life drying in the lake wind. By night, the stars and moon illuminated a world webbed with empty clotheslines and the chaotic shadows they cast. On this night, a figure wove around the hemp ropes and through the faint shadows. Overhead, a sickle moon sliced its way between thin clouds like a god's scimitar. The figure wore soot-stained cloth, wrapped snugly about its torso and limbs, and its face was similarly hidden, leaving only space enough for its eyes, which scanned the nearby rooftops. A black leather harness crisscrossed the figure's chest, bearing pockets and tight, stiff loops holding tools of the trade. Coils of copper wire, iron files, 3 metal saws, each wrapped in oiled parchment, root gum and a squared lump of tallow, a spool of fishing string, a thin-bladed dagger and a throwing knife, both sheathed under the figure's left arm, pommels facing forward. The tips of the thief's moccasins had been soaked in pitch. As he crossed the flat rooftop, he was careful not to lower his full weight on his toes, leaving mostly intact the half-inch strip of sticky tar. He came to the building's edge and looked down. 3 flights below crouched a small garden, faintly lit by 4 gas lamps set at each corner of a flagstoned patio that encircled a fountain. A purple glow clung to the foliage encroaching on the patio and glimmered on the water trickling down a series of stone tiers to the fountain's shallow pool. On a bench beside the fountain sat a guard reclined in sleep, a spear across his knees. The Dahl estate was a popular topic among the higher circles of Darujistan's nobility, specifically for the eligibility of the family's youngest daughter. Many had been the suitors, many the gifts of gems and baubles that now resided in the young maiden's bedroom. While such stories were passed like the sweetest bread in the upper circles, few of the commonry paid attention when the tales trickled down into their company. But there were those who listened carefully indeed, possessive and mute with their thoughts, yet oddly eager for details. His gaze on the dozing houseguard in the garden below, the mind of Crocus Younghand picked its way carefully through speculations of what was to come. The key lay in finding out which room among the estate's score of chambers belonged to the maiden. Crocus did not like guesswork, but he had found that his thoughts, carried almost entirely on instinct, moved with their own logic when determining these things. Top floor almost assuredly for the youngest and fairest daughter of the Dahls, and with a balcony overlooking the garden. He turned his attention from the guard to the wall immediately beneath him. Three balconies, but only one, off to the left, was on the third floor. Crocus pulled back from the edge and slipped silently along the roof until he judged he was directly above the balcony. Then he approached again and looked down. 10 feet at the most. On either side of the balcony rose ornately carved columns of painted wood. A half-moon arch spanned them an arm's length down, completing the fancy frame. With a final glance at the houseguard, who had not moved, and whose spear did not seem in danger of clattering to the flagstones at any moment, Crocus slowly lowered himself down the wall. His moccasin's pitch gripped the eaves with snug assurance. There were plenty of handholds, as the carver had cut deep into the hardwood, and sun, rain, and wind had weathered the paint. He descended along one of the columns until his feet touched the balcony's handrail, where it abutted the wall. A moment later, he crouched on the glazed tiles in the shadow of a wrought-iron table and pillowed chair. No light leaked between the shutters of the sliding door. Two soft steps brought him next to it. A moment's examination identified the style of the latch's lock. Crocus withdrew a fine-tooth saw and set to work. The sound the tool made was minimal, no more than the shivering of a locust's leg. A fine tool, rare and probably expensive. Crocus was fortunate in having an uncle who dabbled in alchemy and had need of such magically hardened tools when constructing his bizarre condensing and filtering mechanisms. Better yet, an absent-minded uncle prone to misplacing things. 20 minutes later, the saw's teeth snipped the last restraining bolt. He returned the tool to his harness, wiped the sweat from his hands, then nudged the door open. Crocus poked his head into the room. In the grey dimness, he saw a large four-poster bed a few feet to his left, its headboard against the outer wall. Mosquito netting descended around it, ending in piled heaps on the floor. From within came the even breaths of someone deep in sleep. The room was redolent of expensive perfume, something spicy and probably from Callows. Immediately across from him were two doors, one ajar and leading into a bathing chamber. The other, a formidable barrier of banded oak, sporting an enormous lock. Against the wall to his right stood a clothes cupboard and a makeup stand, over which stood three polished silver mirrors hinged together. The center one rose flush on the wall, the other two angled onto the tabletop to provide an infinity of admiring visages. Crocus turned sideways and edged into the room. He rose slowly and stretched, relieving his muscles of the tension that had held them for the past half hour. He swung his gaze to the makeup stand, then tiptoed toward it. The Dahl estate was third from the summit of Old Krull's Avenue, which climbed the first of the inner city's hills to a circular court tangled with weeds and irregular, half-buried dolmens. Opposite the court rose Krull Temple, its ancient stones latticed with cracks and entombed in moss. The last monk of the Eldering God had died generations past. The square belfry that rose from the temple's inner court bore architectural stylings of a people long dead. Four rose marble posts marked the corners of the high platform, still holding aloft a peaked roof with sides that were scaled in green-stained bronze tiles. The belfry overlooked a dozen flat roofs of houses that belonged to gentry. One such structure crowded close to one of the temple's rough-hewn walls, and across its roof lay the heavy shadow of the tower. On this roof crouched an assassin, with blood on his hands. Tarlo Crafar of Jurig Donat's clan drew breath in hissing gasps. Sweat trickled muddy streaks down his brow, and droplets fell from his broad, crooked nose. His dark eyes were wide as he stared down at his hands, for the blood staining them was his own. His mission this night had been as a roamer, patrolling the city's rooftops, which, except for the occasional thief, were the assassin's sole domain, the means by which they travelled the city for the most part undetected. The rooftops provided their routes on missions of unsanctioned political activities, or the continuation of a feud between two houses, or the punishment for betrayal. The council ruled by day under public scrutiny. The guild ruled by night, unseen, leaving no witnesses. It had always been this way, since Darujistan first rose on the shores of Lake Azure. Tarlo had been crossing an innocuous rooftop when a crossbow quarrel had driven a hammer blow to his left shoulder. He was flung forward by the concussion and, for an unknown length of time, stared dumbfounded at the cloud-wreathed sky overhead, wondering what had happened. Finally, as numbness slowly gave way to agony, he twisted onto his side. The quarrel had gone entirely through him. It laid on the tarred tiles a few feet away. He rolled until he was beside the bloodied bolt. One glance had been enough to confirm that this was no thief's quarrel. It had come from a heavy weapon, an assassin's weapon. As this fact worked its way through the confused jumble of Tarlo's thoughts, he drew himself up to his knees and then to his feet. An unsteady jog brought him to the building's edge. Blood streamed from the wound as he climbed down to the unlit alley below. His moccasins resting finally on the slick, rubbish-littered cobblestones, he paused, forcing clarity into his head. An assassin war had begun this night. But which clan leader was fool enough to believe he or she could usurp Vorkan's mastery of the guild? In any case, he would return to his clan's nest if possible. With this in mind, he began to run. He had dashed into the shadows of his third alley when ice trickled down his spine. Breath catching, Tarlo froze. The sensation creeping over him was unmistakable, as certain as instinct. He was being stalked. He glanced down at the blood-soaked front of his shirt and realized that there was no hope of outrunning his hunter. No doubt his stalker had seen him enter the alley, and even now had a crossbow trained on its mouth at the far end. At least, that is how Tarlo would play it. He'd have to turn the game round, set a trap, and for that he'd need the rooftops. Tarlo turned back to the alley mouth he had just entered and studied the nearby buildings. Two streets to his right squatted the Krull Temple, his gaze fixed on the dark edifice that was the belfry. There. The climb left him close to unconsciousness, and he now crouched in the belfry's shadow, one building away from the temple. His exertions had pumped blood from his shoulder in horrifying volume. He had seen blood before, of course, but never so much of his own at one time. He wondered for the first time seriously if he would die. A numbness spread in his arms and legs, and he knew if he remained where he was any longer, he might never leave. With a soft grunt, he pushed himself upright. The jump down to the temple roof was only a matter of a few yards, but the impact jarred him to his knees. Gasping, Tarlo drove thoughts of failure from his mind. All that was left was to climb down the temple's inner wall to the court, then ascend the belfry's spiral staircase. Two tasks. Two simple tasks. And once within the belfry's shadows, he could command every nearby rooftop. And the stalker would come to him. Tarlo paused to check his own crossbow, which was strapped to his back, and the three quarrels sheathed on his left thigh. He glared into the darkness around him.
"Whoever you are, you bastard," he whispered. "I want you."
He began to crawl across the temple roof. The lock on the jewel box had proved simple to pick. 10 minutes after entering the room, Crocus had swept it clean. A small fortune's worth of gold and gem and pearl-studded jewelry now resided in a small leather bag tied to his belt. He squatted by the dressing table and held in his hands his final prize.
"This I'll keep."
The item was a sky-blue silk turban with gold-braided tassels, no doubt intended for the upcoming fete. He ended his long minute of admiration, tucked the turban under an arm, then rose. His gaze lingered on the bed across from him, and he moved closer. The netting obscured the form half buried beneath soft blankets. Another step brought him to the bed frame's edge. From the waist up, the girl was naked. An embarrassed flush rose in the thief's cheeks, but he did not look away.
"Queen of dreams, but she's lovely."
At 17 years of age, Crocus had seen enough whores and dancers not to tremble agape at a woman's exposed virtues. Even still, his gaze lingered. Then, grimacing, he headed back to the balcony door. A moment later, he was outside. He drew a deep breath of the cool night air to clear his head. In the blanket of darkness overhead, a handful of stars shone sufficiently bright to pierce the gauze of clouds. Not clouds, but smoke, drifting across the lake from the north. The word of Pale's fall to the Malazan Empire had been on the tongues of everyone for the past 2 days.
"And we're next."
His uncle had told him that the council still frantically proclaimed neutrality, desperate in their efforts to separate the city from the now destroyed Free Cities Alliance. But the Malazans didn't seem to be listening.
"And why should they?" Uncle Mammoth had asked. "The Rujastan's army is a contemptible handful of noble sons, who do nothing but strut back and forth on Whore Street, gripping their jewel swords."
Crocus climbed to the estate's roof and padded silently across its tiles. Another house of equal height was before him, its flat top less than 6 feet away. The thief paused at the edge and looked down to the alley 30 feet below, seeing only a pool of darkness. Then he jumped to land softly on the next roof. He began to cross it. Off to his left rose the stark silhouette of Krull's belfry tower, gnarled like a bony fist thrust into the night sky. Crocus brought one hand down to the leather bag tied to his belt, probing with his fingers the knot and the condition of the drawstrings. Satisfied that all was secure, he checked the turban tucked beneath a strap of his harness. All was well. He continued his soundless way across the rooftop. A fine night indeed. Crocus smiled to himself. Tarlo Crafar opened his eyes. Dazed and uncomprehending, he stared about himself.
Where was he? Why did he feel so weak?
Then memory returned, and a groan slipped from his lips. He had blacked out, leaning here against this marble pillar.
But what had awoken him?
Stiffening, the assassin pushed himself up on the dusty column and scanned the rooftops below.
There!
A figure moved across the flat top of a building less than 50 feet away.
"Now, you bastard, now!"
He raised his crossbow, anchoring one elbow against the pillar. He had already cocked his weapon, though he had no memory of having done so. At this distance, there was no chance of missing. In seconds, his stalker would be dead. Tarlo barred his teeth and took careful aim. Crocus was halfway across the rooftop, one hand tracing the silk finery of the turban snug over his heart, when a coin clattered loudly at his feet. Instinctively, he pounced down and trapped it beneath both hands. Something hissed through the air immediately above his head, and he looked up, startled, then ducked again as a ceramic tile shattered 20 feet away. He moaned with sudden realization. As he clambered to his feet, one hand absently collected the coin and tucked it under his belt. Tarlo cursed in disbelief. He lowered the crossbow and stared down at the figure, dumbfounded, until his instinct for danger asserted itself one last time. Whirling, he caught a blurred glimpse of a cloaked figure standing before him, arms raised. Then the arms flashed down, and two long, grooved daggers slid into Tarlo's chest. With a final, baffled grunt, the assassin died. A grating sound reached Crocus's ears, and he spun to face the belfry. A black shape tumbled from between the pillars and landed with a thump 15 feet away. Moments later, a crossbow clanged down beside it. Crocus looked up to see a silhouette framed between the pillars, glittering long-bladed knives in its hands. The figure seemed to be studying him.
"Oh, Mallory," the thief prayed,
then turned and ran. In the Krull belfry, the killer's oddly shaped eyes watched the thief scamper toward the rooftop's far side. With a slight lifting of its head, the killer sniffed the air, then frowned. A burst of power had just frayed the fabric of night, like a finger poking through rotted cloth. And through the rent, something had come. The thief reached the far edge and disappeared over it. The killer hissed a spell in a language older than the belfry in the temple, a language that had not been heard in this land for millennia, then sprang from the tower. Enwreathed in magic, the killer's descent to the rooftop below was slow, controlled. The landing came as a light brush on the tiles. A second figure appeared, its cloak spread like a black wing from the above darkness to join the first. Then a third, also descending in silence, landed on the rooftop. They spoke briefly. The last to arrive muttered a command, then moved off. The remaining two exchanged a few last words, then set out on the thief's trail, the second one preparing its crossbow. 10 minutes later, Crocus leaned against the slope roof of a merchant's house to regain his breath. He had seen no one, heard nothing. Either the killer hadn't pursued, or he had managed to lose him, or her. In his mind returned his single vision of the figure as it stood in the belfry. No, unlikely that it could be a woman. Too tall, perhaps 6.5 feet, and thin. A tremor ran through the young thief. What had he stumbled on? An assassin had almost skewered him, and then had himself been murdered. A guild war? If so, it made the rooftops a risky place to be. Warily, Crocus rose and looked about him. A tile farther along the roof clattered down the sloped side. Crocus whirled to see the killer dashing toward him. One look at the two daggers flashing in the air, and the thief darted to the roof's edge and leaped out into darkness. The building across from him was too distant, but Crocus had chosen his resting place on familiar territory. As he fell into the shadows, he reached out grasping hands. The guide wire caught his arms near the elbows, and he scrambled frantically for a secure grip, then hung dangling 20 feet above the alley. While most of the clotheslines spanning the city's streets were just thin, unreliable hemp, among them were wrapped wires. Placed by thieves generations past, they were securely bolted to the walls. By day, Monkey Road, as the thieves called it, looked no different from any other line, festooned with undergarments and sheets. With the sun setting, however, came its true purpose. With hands burned raw, Crocus made his way along the wire toward the far wall. He chanced to glance up then, and froze. On the roof's edge before him stood a second hunter, taking careful aim with a heavy, antique crossbow. Crocus let go of the wire. A quarrel whizzed directly above his head as he fell. From behind and below, a window shattered. His drop was cut short by the